Hayan tak og ekki tala islandsk. Thank you for the kind invitation to visit here with you today. And thanks to Gudfrid Lilja and Katrin. It's nice to see you both here. And to our friends at the Reykjavik City Council, Kjartan. I really want to say a special thanks to the City Council for keeping the spirit alive of this event, and also of the Reagan-Gorbachev Summit, which is another seminal moment that we all, or the world, I think, thinks of when they think of Iceland. And on a more personal note, my family and I feel so at home in Reykjavik, and I think the quality of life here owes a lot to the efforts of the City Council and the government at the Althing as well. So thank you for that. There are really a lots of ways to think about this World Championship from 1972. There are different angles that you can approach it by. One, of course, is the chess itself, and I'm not the guy to do that. We have masters, grandmasters here, who, in fact, Frederick said that he actually beat Bobby Fischer twice. And I wouldn't know a Sicilian defense if I met it on the street. So I'm not going to talk about the chess. Second is the cultural impact, which Gudfrid Lilja alluded to a moment ago. And it really was a cultural phenomenon, this chess match. And I was 9 years old at the time in Minnesota, back in the United States. And I remember hearing, you know, Boris Spassky, Bobby Fischer playing chess. And to think that a chess match, you know, thousands of miles away actually penetrated the consciousness of a 9-year-old American kid in the United States tells you something about the global impact of that match. And, excuse me, and I also, you know, started playing chess, I'm sure, because of the effects of the match and the importance that it played. Another thing to think about for the match, and you all can also speak much better to this, is the venue. I asked Frederick a moment ago, you know, why was it in Reykjavik? And he said that, well, Iceland was a respected player in the world of chess. And I think it's also that Reykjavik did, and Iceland did, show itself to be kind of a halfway point geographically between Russia, Soviet Union, and the United States. And this, of course, was used again as a venue for the Reagan-Gorbachev summit in 1986, which was historic in its own right. So, as a diplomat and a person who spent a lot of time in Russia and the Soviet Union before that, I think the one aspect of the match that is fascinating is the looking at it through the prism of the Cold War. And, of course, one of the reasons I think that it did attract so much attention at the time is that it was a sporting match between, you know, the two Cold War rivals. And if we look back at 1972 and we think about what were the big events of that year, in addition to the chess championship, we quickly see that the Cold War was really a dominant factor in world events. We look at 1972, we had President Nixon doing this breakthrough visit to Beijing. And that, of course, was driven in large part by a desire for the United States to triangulate and create a tension between Russia and China and to get an advantage in the Cold War. Another historic event in 1972 was the fact that the last American walked on the moon that year. And we, of course, just marked the passing of Neil Armstrong, who was the first man to walk on the moon. And we have to remember the entire NASA drive to go to the moon was a product of the Cold War. It was a desire to compete with the Soviet Union, which had put the first man in space, of course, Yuri Gagarin. And this, of course, had implications for the arms race and the effectiveness of intercontinental missiles. So again, another seminal event in 1972. And another event was something that all of our Canadian friends will remember, and that was the really historic for the Canadians and the Soviets, I think, the hockey match that was played that summer in 1972. They played four games in Soviet Union and four games in Canada. And Canada just barely won, literally in the last few minutes. And for Canadians, this was a huge, huge event. And again, it was seen very much through the prism of the Cold War, because hockey for Canadians is their national sport, and they saw the rivalry with the Soviets as more than just a game. It was political as well. So here we have a chess match, and I think it's really surprising that suddenly there's this American teenager in the 60s who emerges as this magnificent chess prodigy, and he's suddenly able to even compete against the Soviets, who have been dominant really in the chess world both before and after Bobby Fischer came along. And so this instantly, I imagine, suddenly it became another, you know, Cold War battlefield. And a clear indication of that is the fact that Henry Kissinger actually phoned up Bobby Fischer when he was wavering about whether he was going to come to Reykjavik at all. And then when he was here, he, of course, famously refused to show up for one of the matches. And Henry Kissinger called him again. And this is, you know, again, the middle of the Cold War. Henry Kissinger is worried about the Middle East. He's opening the relations with China. And yet, this is important enough in his mind, in this geopolitical battle, that it's worth him trying to convince Bobby Fischer to play on and you know, hopefully, obviously, beat the Soviets. So again, it's I think that as I've, you know, studied this over the last few days, I've just become fascinated by the history behind this match and the historical, geopolitical, even context. Really, the other fascinating thing about the match, of course, is Bobby Fischer himself and his personality and the issues his own life raises about the questions of celebrity. He was, I think, in the 70s, you had, of course, in the 60s, you had the Beatles kind of emerging as world world celebrities, and Bobby Fischer was part of that role too. And it has to have been a very difficult process for a very young man to face all of that. And even I think in his own mental issues, his eccentricities, I think were probably derived in part from the problems of being thrust onto the stage, the world stage, at a very young age, and losing your privacy. And I think there are also a lot of other layers, of course, to his personal story, and one of them is kind of a very ironic Cold War element to his own history, which is his mother was born in Russia, I believe, or her parents certainly were, and she, though, was a really diehard communist, and she also devoted a lot of her energies to politics, and ended up leaving him, which I think at a young age, at the age of 16. So I think that kind of fueled his own anti-Russian and ultimately anti-Semitic emotions and views. And so in a sense, there was kind of a Cold War going on within his own family that, again, I think played into the problems that he had later in life. Another thing, as I've thought through this, is there are actually some similarities between Bobby Fischer himself and Iceland. In one sense, you have, and here I'm talking about kind of mother nature and human nature, and I think one word that you can use to describe both Bobby Fischer and Iceland is extreme. And think about the definitions of extreme. We have the farthest removed from the ordinary, or exceeding the bounds of moderation. And Iceland's nature and landscape, I think, really exemplifies this word extreme. If we think about the Vatnajökull Glacier, if we think about these bubbling pools of mud at Krisovik, and the desolation of the lava fields that we see everywhere. And for you Icelanders, maybe, you know, this is totally normal. But for us coming from outside, this is extreme. And in fact, in 1972, of course, Iceland showed how extreme it can be in terms of geology, with the eruption of the volcano in Heimi, when suddenly this field split open and hot lava started spewing out for 6 months and created a new mountain, and of course almost closed the harbor there. And I think Bobby Fischer is also, obviously, he had extreme eccentricities, extreme genius. When I think of what song might best describe him, I think of Simon Garfunkel's song, "I'm a Rock, I'm an Island." And I was chatting earlier this morning, and the question for me is now, were his problems later in life, were they linked at all to, you know, playing chess? This might be an uncomfortable question for this audience. But I was talking with Krop, and he said, no, most chess players are quite normal. But then I was looking at some quotations about chess, and Albert Einstein said, "Chess holds its master in its own bonds. shackling the mind and brain so that the inner freedom of the very strongest must suffer. And H.G. Wells said, there is no remorse like the remorse of chess. It is a curse upon man. There is no happiness in chess. So, okay, you might dismiss these because, you know, these are not, you know, real chess players. Garry Kasparov, though, he said, chess is mental torture. and he should know. So I guess in reflecting on all this and it's an open question whether Bobby Fischer was predestined to the man he became and the tragedy that he became, or whether chess played some role in that. And I saw a great film that was actually at the Reykjavik International Film Festival last year, the Bobby Fischer Against the World. And one of his Icelandic friends in that film, I think it was Kari Stefansson, he said, Bobby Fischer's genius and his illness were joined at the hip. And I guess the conclusion that I lead ultimately from this is that if we live at the extreme, or if Mother Nature or human nature gives us this gift, whether it's a gift or not may be debatable, but if we live at the extreme, that may be a path to greatness. But I'm not certain, and I don't think that it's definitely a road to happiness. So I want to thank you, the organizers, again for keeping the memory of this event alive. And I want to wish the participants in the matches, the tournament this afternoon, the best of luck. And thank you again for the invitation.